An appeals court blocks the Trump administration's Remain in Mexico program, but another immigration policy is poised to take its place.
The Trump administration anticipated it's had mixed luck with its immigration policies in the courts, and so it actually anticipated that Remain in Mexico might get knocked down by a court at some point, and so it created these other pathways.
And how Democrats and Republicans are framing the economy on the campaign trail.
Certainly, until the coronavirus panic spread, one of the things that President Trump has been touting a lot has been the strong stock market.
It's Friday, February 28th. I'm Charlie Turner for The Wall Street Journal. Here's what's news. U.S. stock markets just finished their worst week since the financial crisis. Concerns about the economic fallout of the coronavirus epidemic pushed the Dow Jones Industrial Average down 357 points on Friday. Stock losses have been broad, with all 11 of the S&P 500 sectors dropping into negative territory for the year. All three major indexes fell more than 10% for the week. Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell signaled Friday that the central bank was preparing to cut interest rates if needed. Traders had begun wagering that the Fed would cut rates as soon as next month. The Fed trimmed interest rates three times last year. Mexico has confirmed its first case of coronavirus infection. It's now the second country in Latin America after Brazil to report the presence of the virus. A 35-year-old in Mexico City has been placed in isolation, according to the health ministry. A second person in the Pacific Coast state of Sinaloa is being treated for likely infection. Both people in recent weeks had visited Italy, which is where authorities believe they contracted the virus. The biggest supplier of parts for Boeing's 737 MAX jet plans to restart limited production in March. Spirit AeroSystems said it plans to gradually resume making fuselages, engine pylons, and other parts for the MAX, regardless of when Boeing gets the green light from regulators to resume commercial service. The jet has been grounded worldwide since last March after two fatal crashes claimed 346 lives. A federal appeals court has ruled that the Trump administration must hold up its Remain in Mexico policy. Joining us now to discuss it and another of the administration's immigration policies is The Wall Street Journal's Michelle Hackman. Michelle, remind us how Remain in Mexico works.
Sure. So the policy was set up about a year ago. The Trump administration had this problem. You'll remember last spring where a ton, about 850,000 migrants crossed the border, started overwhelming border facilities, border agents. They didn't have anywhere to put them. By law in particular, the government has to release families into the United States after 20 days of detention. They can't detain them forever. And the Trump administration thought this was a really bad idea. You know, they thought these people don't have a right to stay if they lose their asylum claims. They might not even show up to court. And so Remain in Mexico became sort of their big solution. They said, rather than detaining these people, we're going to send them back across the border to these Mexican border cities where they can wait and sort of come and attend their court dates, often at a court set up sort of right at the border, sometimes under a tent.
Now, what did the federal appeals court say?
Now, the appeals court said that the policy is sort of inconsistent with federal immigration law and also on international treaties around refugees and human rights. You know, I think that the court said that the United States is not doing enough to protect these asylum seekers from danger. The cities on the northern Mexican border, on our border, are extremely dangerous. Many of them are rated by the State Department as just as dangerous as places like Afghanistan or Syria. And there were a lot of cases, a lot of reporting that the court actually pointed to of, these asylum seekers getting kidnapped, sexually assaulted, sort of taken for ransom in many cases because they became targets.
Now, Michelle, if we can switch gears, there's a different Trump administration policy you've written about called PACER that's meant to rapidly review asylum claims. Why don't you give us the basics of how this program works?
Sure. So I want to back up for a second and say, you know, I've laid out the larger problem here. They don't want to let people into the United States. PACER, you know, the Trump administration anticipated it's had mixed luck with its immigration policies in the courts. And so it actually anticipated that Remain in Mexico might get knocked down by a court at some point. And so it created these other pathways. PACER is one of them. PACER is a program that is designed to take asylum seekers, subject them to an initial screening interview, and for other reasons, these people sort of don't qualify for regular asylum, and so they have to meet this really high legal standard to be able to stay in the United States. Most don't pass. And so the program is designed to take those people that don't pass within a couple days and really quickly deport them. So those people don't linger in the United States. Those people aren't sent to Mexico. And I think now that Remain in Mexico has been halted and the administration can't send more people to Mexico, we'll see this program PACER really grow.
This presents additional hurdles to asylum seekers, I believe, the biggest of which is probably the time limit.
Yeah, so I wrote about the case of a Guatemalan woman today in the journal who actually went through the PACER program. Now, the program is quite secretive. The government won't answer most questions about it. We just learned yesterday that about 2,500 people have gone through this program so far. It's been an experiment up until recently. But I read the case documents of this one woman from Guatemala. She's an indigenous woman. She had been threatened in her home by local gang members. They threatened to take her child away from her unless she paid a ransom. So she sort of ran away. And the story really goes into all the details of when you have so few days to present your case and then you really quickly get deported. First of all, it's tough to find a lawyer to begin with. You're in detention. In this case, the woman had a family member in the United States who found a lawyer for her. But by the time the lawyer tried to intervene, it was already too late. She was getting deported. And, you know, she hit several other legal hurdles as well.
And this program has gotten criticism, and several organizations have sued to block it. What are their concerns?
I'd say some of the big concerns are, again, that access to counsel, finding a lawyer. In the case of the woman I wrote about, her name is Juliana Garcia. When she found a lawyer, her lawyer had to have her sign a document so that the government would recognize the lawyer as her lawyer. But she was in detention, and her lawyer wasn't even allowed to come see her to get that signature. So you can imagine the sort of catch-22 that this sets up. And it's apparently, you know, more common than just this case.
You describe this as an experimental program. Might they dispense with it if they find that it doesn't work or if it gets blocked by the court?
I will say that the administration considered this program extremely effective. Even before today's case ending Remain in Mexico, we've already seen the administration starting to shift newly arriving migrants into PACER as sort of their preferred program, or under a third program, sending them to Guatemala to ask for asylum instead. And so I think quite the contrary, the Department of Homeland Security has said they expect that PACER should be available sort of at every border station border-wide this month.
Wall Street Journal reporter Michelle Hackman joining us from Washington. Thanks, Michelle.
Thank you.
As is the case with every U.S. election, the economy is a key issue this year. Fears of a possible coronavirus pandemic have created new uncertainty over the election year economy. Up to now, the strength of the economy is something that President Trump has been using to his advantage. But Democrats say the strong data masks the ongoing worries of millions of Americans. Joining us to talk about this is The Wall Street Journal's Jake Schlesinger. By a lot of measures, Jake, the economy has been prospering in recent years, but there are other measures that paint a different picture. How are the major political parties interpreting the economic data?
So the Republicans, President Trump in particular, and his Republican supporters, are emphasizing the good data. And it should be made clear there is a lot of good data by historical standards, by a lot of traditional measures. This economy is doing great, notably the unemployment rate, which is the most visible piece of political economic data, is at or near a 50-year low. So on that side, they would say things are booming, wages are growing as well, which they hadn't for a long time. On the other side, Democrats say, yes, by those traditional benchmarks, the economy perhaps is doing well, but that the economy has changed in significant and structural ways, and that things that used to be a sign of a healthy economy, even a low unemployment rate, now come with a lot of flashing warning signs and worry signs as well, and so that a lot of people can still feel a lot of distress, even with a low unemployment rate.
In general, how has the public been feeling about the economy?
You know, that's one of the really interesting things that we came across when we were researching this piece, which is, so you hear that consumer confidence is at or near all-time highs, and the benchmarks generally are. But when you dissect various measures of consumer confidence, we looked at the University of Michigan's Consumer Sentiment Index, but similar things show up in Gallup polling, Pew polling. There's a huge divide between people who call themselves Republicans and people who call themselves Democrats, in which people who say that they're Republicans feel incredibly upbeat about the economy right now, not just the economy overall, but their own personal finances. And people who call themselves Democrats feel incredibly downbeat, both about the economy and their personal finances. And one of the things that we highlight, which was really intriguing in the Michigan Sentiment Survey, is just look at the flip in 2016, that the most recent, or rather the Michigan's last data point before the 2016 election in October showed Democrats as most upbeat, Republicans as downbeat. And almost overnight, when the election happened, those two lines just flipped. And the gap has gotten bigger and bigger and bigger. And Michigan says that that since they started asking for partisan affiliation since the Reagan administration, the gap between how the two parties or people affiliated with the two parties see the economy has never been bigger.
And how about stocks, which until recently were at record highs?
Right. So the stock market is an interesting one, although, of course, you know, it's certainly changed a lot in the final days of February.
Taking it on the chin.
Exactly. But you know, certainly until the coronavirus panic spread, you know, one of the things that President Trump has been touting a lot has been the strong stock market. And it has been a very robust stock market. And he's liked to talk about how he feels like that has spread the wealth widely. He talks a lot about 401ks and how people at his rallies are seeing this in their 401ks. And there's obviously some truth to that. But the stock market even now, even with the spread of 401ks, is still a relatively concentrated asset. There are a large number of people who don't have any stock in any form, and an even larger number who have relatively little stock. It really, for the bottom 50%, remains a tiny, tiny fraction of what is held by the top 10%.
Why can't we seem to settle on a single way of looking at the economy that everyone agrees
on?
You
know, I mean, partly, you know, there's always going to be disagreements. I mean, obviously, a strong economy is always in an incumbent president's interest, and so his opponents will always try and talk down that economy. I think, though, it is different now for two reasons. One is I think the partisanship is much greater, as we were talking about a little bit earlier, and so I think, you know, the ability of Democrats and Republicans to agree on anything, like whether the sky is blue or the grass is green, let alone, you know, what's the condition of the economy, is becoming more and more difficult. But also the economy is going through structural changes, and in structural changes in ways that we haven't really seen before, we haven't really experienced before. And so, you know, whether those structural changes are good or bad, they churn up a lot of uncertainty and therefore a lot more debate.
Thanks a lot, Jake.
Thank you.
You can find Jake's story with charts and graphics by searching for Polarized Prosperity at WSJ.com. And finally, a look ahead to South Carolina. On Saturday, the Democratic presidential candidates will be facing the first in the South primary there. The Wall Street Journal's Valerie Borlein says a lot of moderate Democrats in the South are unsettled by the frontrunner status of progressive Senator Bernie Sanders.
A lot of Democrats here are nervous about a Sanders win and Sanders becoming the nominee, because in a red state like South Carolina and in other red states and swing states in the South, there's real fear among Democrats that Sanders will just lose big time. I mean, lose like McGovern level, who lost 49 states back in 72. So I think one of the things I'm looking for tomorrow is whether Biden wins resoundingly or wins by a narrow margin, or if Sanders or someone else, even Tom Steyer, can pull off an upset, and what that'll tell us about Sanders' ongoing strength.
The Wall Street Journal's Valerie Borlein. And that's What's News for this Friday afternoon. If you like our show, please rate and review us wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Charlie Turner for The Wall Street Journal. Thanks for listening.